The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back as we head into hour two of our daily three-hour tour. As promised, it is a delight and privilege to bring back to the show, it's been a while, one of my favorite historians, Dr. Alvin Felsenburgh. Dr. Felsenburgh is the author of several books, including a book about William Buckley, A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley. And he was one of the featured commentators and historians in the American Masters special that aired Friday night that we've been speaking about. Dr. Felsenburgh, Al, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm well, Seth. How are you?
It's really nice to talk to you, and it was so good to hear your voice on that American Masters series.
Thank you. My best to you and all the listeners out in Phoenix.
You betcha. You betcha. Of all the books you've written, by the way, was your book on William Buckley the most fun to write? I'm guessing yes, because he was so fun.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he was a great wit. He was a great original. And he was a man of great fundamental decency. So getting a chance to spend 5 or 6 years with him was a great pleasure.
I originally was going to interview you Friday, and we both said, well, wait, maybe we watch it first, because you didn't know what they were going to use either of your interviews.
No, I didn't know what they were going to use, and I didn't know where they were going with it. So.
Yeah. Go ahead. Give us your thoughts on it. We'll get into some specifics, but
okay,
overall,
well,
how?
Yeah. Well, first of all, from the editor's point of view, it's very hard to use all that material.
Yeah.
You know, we're dealing with 80 plus years,
yeah.
And he had some magnificent visuals, which I think were stellar.
Yep.
Some of the color shots were great.
Yep.
Some of the footage of the mayoral campaigns and the sailing and all of that was wonderful. And there's a sense of balance you tried to do. He had a certain amount of liberal commentators and a certain amount of conservative commentators and what have you. We had a few friends of Bill, and some people knew him, some people less so. And I think it could have taken a healthy cut of the last 3 minutes.
Yeah, that's what I think.
You know, the man died 13 years ago, and to say that conservatism, that the conservative movement, inevitably leads to the events of January 6th,
yeah,
was a stretch.
Yeah.
And we have comments of his. In fact, I'm writing another piece on him now. And the things he said about George Wallace after the Birmingham bombing.
Yeah.
This is not a man that would have been part of a movement that furthered violence of any kind, whatever the cause.
I don't even know if he would have supported nonviolent. My producer, we colloquially call him Young David, but he's the oldest young person you'd know. Young David and I were watching an interview, 1972, Bill Buckley on the Dick Cavett Show, where Bill Buckley said, "I don't even believe in civil disobedience."
Well, he did not.
Yeah.
This is my piece.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't understand. He said he didn't understand how you change the law by breaking it. He didn't buy that notion. He said, okay, today Martin Luther King says this law is bad, so we have permission to break it. Well, who decides which ones should be broken?
Right.
And the way to deal with that is to go through the legislature, and failing that, enforce the law, and it'll force a bad law, and force the legislature to change it. Calvin Coolidge said that during the Bolshevik scare in the early 20s when Wall Street was bombed and some other things happened. And he said, there are a lot of things that are wrong in this country, and I'm going to enforce the good laws and repeal the bad ones. So, yes, he did not agree in civil disobedience. He did not like the protests and the street culture. He certainly hated Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
He was certainly around for that.
Yeah. Well.
So, yes, I think that's consistent.
I want to spend a little time, if I can, with you. By the way, do you have a little time for us this evening?
Yeah, I do.
You're very generous.
I do. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I do.
I want to spend a little time on the debate.
The debate.
I guess everyone gets a the something. Reagan had the speech. Buckley gets the debate. We're talking, of course, about the James Baldwin debate.
Okay.
A lot came out of it. One of the things that you would not have known that came out of it from the documentary was that Buckley's views that he professed there did change.
I'm writing about that right now.
Okay, good.
And they did change. They changed. Well, you asked the question. I can walk you through it, but yeah. I'd rather you ask me. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, okay. So anyone who watches that debate today, if you're fair-minded, I think the takeaway you get is, oh my gosh, what a masterful performance. What an unbelievably excellent performance taking exactly the wrong side. That's what I thought.
Well, yeah. You have to go back to the year. The year was the early 1960s. There was an atmosphere of change. Things were turning around a little bit. I think the sit-ins had begun. Buckley's point, not wonderfully made, is if we are as racist as you say, why are white people reading your books?
Yeah, why are you the toast of the town? Right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Why are you the toast of the town?
Yeah.
And why are you always angry? Baldwin was much nicer to Buckley than he was to Bobby Kennedy.
I mean, yes.
Bobby Kennedy had a group of black leaders to the White House, and Baldwin was saying he would encourage young black men not to fight for their country, and Bobby Kennedy almost threw him out of the window.
Mm-hmm.
So how was that persuading you? No, he didn't make that case very well with Oxford. And his argument that we had too many ignorant and uninformed white voting is particularly whites in Chicago whose votes are manipulated. Why is it a good thing in the name of democracy to have more ill-informed people who are used to being oppressed and manipulated voting?
Right.
It came out very badly when he structured the sentence, but it was a wrong argument to some degree, and he did come around. Several things brought him around. I think, again, the violence, which is the one thing I object to in the documentary.
Right.
The violence brought him around. Wallace used to be very cavalier in his choice of rhetoric. He always talked about blood will flow,
mm-hmm.
and other things happening, and if it's going to cost us blood to preserve our way of life and our Southern purity, then we're going to have to deal with it. He said, with his offensive rhetoric, he basically demonized the devil. And the devils, of course, are the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were acting as perhaps not as Governor Wallace would have wanted them to act, but they were turned on by the fact that a person in authority condoned this kind of behavior. And four little girls died as a result of it. It happened the week after the March on Washington.
We have a monument to them here in Phoenix. Next time you're out here, I will show you. Yes, yes.
Well,
yes.
I would like to do
one
that
of them was
I'm
a good
there.
Friend of Condi Rice's, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yes. Condi talked about her a great deal and her family.
Yeah.
And that really got to him. So he wrote a letter to his mother. Buckley was a devout Catholic, as we know, and most people said he got the intellectual Catholicism from his father. And he can argue continental Catholicism with other forms and usually held his own. But when it came to praying and when it came to figuring out the human existence, he's talked to his mother a great deal. And he wrote her a letter and said, how do the principles of Christianity justify racial separation? And we're certainly not told that during communion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the few times we saw blacks in our church was when they were taking communion.
Mm-hmm.
How come we live separately and how come they can't take the same jobs we can and they can't go to school with us? This is while he's also writing against the 64 Civil Rights Bill.
Right.
He's going through this mental turmoil. And she says she would, pray for him and an inspiration would come. In the meantime, he would talk to a priest, which he did. He talked to several theologians at Fordham University for an answer. Two people come into his life when he's running for mayor. One is Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who wrote the Beyond the Melting Pot with Nathan Glaser the same year that Bill was running for mayor. And Moynihan's talking about the crisis of the family and certain actions government did do in the New Deal and elsewhere to penalize families and discourage men from living at home and all of that stuff. And you might remember Barry Gray was the radio talk host. And one of the last intellectual radio talk shows. But he could hold his own with Moynihan and with Buckley.
One of the last. Here, let me take a quick commercial break, Professor Felsenberg, if you'll allow me. Something that they didn't do on Firing Line because they didn't have to, but we have to. Dr. Al Felsenberg is my guest. We're talking about the life of William Buckley and this American Masters series. He himself wrote a book on Buckley and was featured in the American Masters series. Al Felsenberg and I will be right back. Well, there's that familiar music. It's Haydn, I believe. Dr. Al Felsenberg is our guest. He is one of my favorite historians. He is an author of several books. The one most relevant for our discussion, A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley. He was featured in the American Masters series. He's taught at every famous university there is. He's taught a lot of people. I count myself a student of Al's. Al, you were talking about Buckley's run for mayor, which I think was the same year as the Baldwin debate, if I'm not mistaken. I think they both were 65.
The Baldwin debate was, I think, in February or March.
Okay, fair enough.
The mayoral race he announced in May.
Okay. Buckley got to know Moynihan, and then you were telling me about the radio host as well.
When Buckley was running for mayor, he didn't have a primary because he had the conservative line to himself. Moynihan didn't like working in the Johnson administration anymore, so he was lured home by Mayor Wagner, and he went on the ticket with Paul Scrivain for mayor and Moynihan for president of the city council. And he listened to Moynihan's debates, and he found out about Beyond the Melting Pot. And after the primary, he began to quote from that book when he went to different neighborhoods, particularly African-American neighborhoods and Irish neighborhoods. And Barry Gray was one of the great talk show hosts in the world. And one of the few who could hold his own with Moynihan and with Buckley. Moynihan, and he was off like 11 to 1 o'clock, and I was just sneaking in my bed, not waking my parents because my mother was going to school. And it was on until 1 in the morning, so those days I would, all right. So Moynihan would go on, and he said, you know, I'm tired of listening to your friend, Mr. Buckley, plagiarize me daily. Taking every speech he's done from my book. So Buckley called the show the next day. I would instruct the learned professor, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, that I do not plagiarize him. I quote him in every sentence. And so they became intimate friends. And he said, I'll send him a dictionary when we have lunch. And the other one was Whitney Young, who was running the Urban League. And Moynihan was working with Nixon on the family maintenance, black family, family assistance, and negative income taxes. And under Reagan became another form of transfer payments to redistribute income from to the poor people who need it, working poor, they called it. And North said, why don't we send 21 journalists into the ghetto, into the cities where we had riots 2 years ago, Detroit, Newark, Watts, other places. And he sends Buckley around, and he starts walking up to these street blacks, militants, who are running their privately funded storefronts. And they're taking around Chicago, and they say, why don't you sit down here and look out the window with me? All right, looking out the window, what am I waiting for? Oh, 5 minutes, a cop car will come up, and a cop will leave and go into the back. There's a numbers racket in the back, and he's going to walk out with three shopping bags of very expensive liquor, and that's the payoff so they don't get shut down. Now, our children see that, And how are we supposed to tell them to respect the cops, Mr. Buckley? You've been writing about this most of your life.
Wow.
You don't like review boards. You don't like this. You don't like that. How can we have faith in these kinds of folks?
Yeah.
Well, then he went from city to city, and he got these kinds of stories. And he said, you know, they don't like bureaucracy. I don't like bureaucracy. They hate the federal government. They know the federal government isn't out to help them. I feel the same way. And, you know, but for the grace of God, I could be they. And but for a bit of income in their parents, they could be me.
Yep.
And he wrote about that. And he said, you won't find such better rhetoric and such greater commitment to the finest graduate schools in the land.
Wow.
He wrote a series of columns on that. And again, you don't get that from many people who write about him. But he was a different man. I credit Whitney Young, and I credit Moynihan, because he understood poverty from a theoretical point of view.
Yeah.
And he had seen in the South a lot of docility in the world he grew up with. You had two societies. You had the white society and the black society. And he was from the more genteel Southern aristocrats on his mother's side, particularly. But he hadn't had to deal with this kind of urban culture before. And he was running for mayor. He had run for mayor and learned a great deal doing that. And he began to relate to African-Americans quite well. He had many on his show, many leaders that most people wouldn't put on. He had Huey Newton on.
Yep.
He had Jesse Jackson on.
Yep. Andrew Young,
he had
Muhammad Ali, maybe.
Muhammad Ali,
yeah.
when he was dodging the draft,
right.
You recall.
Right.
They were all on, and he gave them an audience that a lot of networks didn't at the time. I missed the show. It was a delight in television. I don't know if it would have survived Netflix and the breaking up of cable and everything else we're dealing with now, but it ran its run for a good 33 years.
There's two things from that story I want to bring up, Al, and I'll start with this one. One is, and I don't think the documentary got into it, but interestingly, towards the end of his life, he became consumed with the issue of anti-Semitism too.
Oh yes. It started with the Pat Buchanan campaign.
Yes. Wrote a book on it. Made some ex-friends over it.
He lost friends over it. He lost staff over it. But he thought back to the kind of what he called the genteel anti-Semitism he actually heard at his father's table. And he began to think of how different the world was at that point. But even as an undergraduate, you don't get any points for going to Skull and Bones, but
right.
He got the first Jewish member admitted.
Oh, is that right?
His friend was Tom Ginsberg, and he was the founder of Viking Books.
Oh, no kidding.
And he was Buckley's roommate the whole 4 years at Yale.
No kidding.
And in his final career, he was Jackie Editor's final editor at Doubleday when she went back to work.
Oh,
okay. And Buckley said, all right, they want me because I'm the head of the Yale Daily News, which is a big deal.
Yeah.
They don't want him because they never had a Jewish member. So I'm going to tell them we come in together or we don't come at all.
Like what Frank Sinatra did with black musicians in his band.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a great story about Frank Sinatra in Miami, which I can tell you about.
You know what? We're going to hit a break, but let's do it on the other side. And let me tee up the other question, too, if you're willing to stay with us. The other question I wanted to ask you about, they did say this in the documentary, and I guess I never assimilated the point, but it said it was his mayoral run that really turned him into a hero of the working class, if you will, or at least the working concern. And I guess I never really put that together, but I can give you a nice vignette on it, and you do the Sinatra one, and we'll do it all when we come right back. Al Felsenburgh is my guest, historian. You can go to his website, alvinfelsenburgh.com, F-E-L-Z-E-N-B-E-R-G, author of many books, including one on Bill Buckley, and a featured historian and commentator during the American Masters, on the American Masters Buckley show. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Dr. Al Felsenberg is our guest. We're talking about the American Masters documentary on William Buckley. We're talking about William Buckley. Point of departure, Al, if you wanted, you said you had a fun story about Frank Sinatra, who also gets a lot of attention. Go ahead.
Real quick. Yeah. After World War II, he came down to perform in all the great hotels. Miami Beach was growing at that time after both wars. It was a big boom for Miami Beach. And he noted Ella Fitzgerald was part of his troupe. They traveled around the country. And he began to wonder, you know, she disappears at night.
Yeah.
And she said, well, she had an aunt in Liberty Square, which is a village near Miami, maybe even part of the city. It's the only place blacks could own a property and own businesses and all. And she stayed with her aunt. He said, why don't you stay with us? The fountain blew. What's the matter with you? And he said, well, they won't let black people stay in the hotel where they entertain.
Yeah.
And so I'm the same quality as a maid, I guess.
Yeah.
They clean the room and they can't stay in them. So he went to the management and he threatened a big bang with the musicians union. He got all the musicians to sign up. I don't know how the story ended, but it was on the front page of the Miami Herald for about a month.
Wow.
He threatened to boycott the city and never returned. And I heard the same story in a different way about Marilyn Monroe. That there was a segregated part of Los Angeles, and they wouldn't let Ella sing there. They said she was too black and too fat. And Marilyn said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll come every night that she sings, and you give her a two-week contract, and I'll give you 10 days. And lo and behold, I mean, she packed the house every night, and I guess the
I love those stories. God, you know, it just people who want to denounce this, it's a beautiful part of our country over unbeautiful moments.
Well, there are beautiful moments in America.
Yeah, Al.
Working class.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So when Buckley died, you'll remember Bill Bennett and I used to do his radio show together. Uh-huh. We did a day for him, a tribute, and you might have been on it. And we had a caller. We had a trucker call in from I don't remember where, and he said, "I'll tell you about William Buckley." He goes, "I remember the first time I heard him speak. I probably didn't understand about 90% of what he said, but I knew I wanted to, and I loved that.
Right.
I loved that.
Well, the conservative party started to make the Republican Party a little less liberal than it was under Nelson Rockefeller, and he had been the boss of New York for a long, long time, and were shutting conservatives out. And the idea that so he would make it impossible to get on the primary ballot. He had state workers challenging petitions and all of that stuff. So they started their own party and they began fielding candidates in 1961. In 1965, he announced his for mayor because he didn't want John Lindsay to be nominated for president and thereby have two liberal parties. And he knew that if a liberal Republican won in New York for the mayoralty, that they would immediately draft him, he thought. So he was going to run to stop that. And the result was that Manhattan was his worst borough. He got 7% of the vote in Manhattan, and he lost all the Wall Street precincts in the Upper East Side and all the places they were sure that these Wall Streeters were going to object to Rockefeller spending and all his liberalism. But he soared in Staten Island. He almost carried it, came in a narrow second to the Democratic candidate. Or no, second to Lindsay. But he almost carried it, and he did extremely well in Queens and to some extent in Brooklyn. And he was getting support of cab drivers, grocers, cops, teachers, people who made the city go, and people who he said, much better than I ever will, they're very trapped. The schools are deteriorating. The courts want to bus in people who are just new to the city, and they're going to bring drugs and all sorts of things with them, which did happen. And then they say you can't have aid to private parochial schools. So they're double taxed if they take their kids out and send them to the diocese schools, which are working. And they can't let them out, and they're forcing other things to come in. And they call them racist if they complain. And it's either going to working-class towns in New Jersey, just like the one that they're leaving, or it's to stand their ground and fight. And a lot of the arguments came out of the Moynihan book, again, The Melting Pot, where he talks about the two Democratic parties in New York. One is the New Deal Democratic Party of the Adlai Stevenson types, and the Upper East Side crowd, the Eleanor Roosevelt wannabes. And then you had Tammany. And that's what the fight was about every time for mayor and for governor. And if the two sides could get together, they would elect a governor. Otherwise, the Republican could slip through, and it was usually a liberal. But when the head of the Conservative Party saw that Buckley's votes were not coming from disenchanted Republicans, he said he felt like he had ashes in his mouth.
Wow.
But it was the beginning.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. This was a short segment. We'll have a longer one coming up. You look at the three people running for mayor mainly in that debate, Abe Beame, John Lindsay, William Buckley. My friend Tevi Troy, Al's friend, says two of them were mayor. The only one we're talking about is the one who wasn't. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Professor Al Felsenberg is our guest, alvinfelsenberg.com, his website, author of many books, including the one most relevant today, A Man and Its Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley. Al, right before the break, I did a quick quip by a mutual friend of ours, Tevi Troy, and I think maybe there's a lot in that quip of Tevi's.
There's a great deal to it.
Yeah, right. I was showing Tevi, you know, a Meet the Press where they had Abe Beame, John Lindsay, and Bill Buckley. And Tevi goes, of those three, two were mayors, and the one we still talk about wasn't. There's a lot in there, isn't there?
He got 13% of the vote.
Yeah.
And Lindsay was running to be president. Beame was a 35-year-old bureaucrat, a 35-year, rather, bureaucrat. He had one job. He worked in the city budget office. Managed to become controller on Wagner's ticket and wanted to round out his pension. Probably did have the biggest pension in New York State history. And Buckley wanted to change the world.
Yeah.
And we're still talking about him.
Yeah. I guess I was going to ask you that question. I don't mean to interrupt. If you want to keep going, go ahead. I was going to ask you this. And I should have done it at the top, but maybe now's as good a time as any to raise it. Why was Buckley important, Al?
Well, he did change the world. He took a philosophy that was considered on the fringe, particularly after Barry Goldwater's defeat. No one wanted to stand up and say, well, let's do this all over again. And he had a speech on this. They picked up the ashes and they planned the Long March. And they shed some of their extremists, as many as he could get out. They broadened the base to include the people we're talking about, working people from the outer boroughs, law enforcement types, city clerks, cops, firefighters, those people who are beatified during 9/11 and ignored the rest of the year.
Yeah, good way to put
it. And all of that, and they became part of Nixon's silent majority and Reagan Democrat and all of that. It all started with Buckley's campaign. It was Barry Goldwater. I want to say nice things about him to the people of Phoenix.
Yep.
He came to a Conservative Party fundraiser a month after Buckley lost the campaign. And he gave a great speech about Bill, and he ended by said, Bill Buckley lost the election, but he won the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he changed the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no question. There would have been no Ronald Reagan without William Buckley. I'm absolutely convinced of it.
Yeah.
He felt they needed a warmer, fuzzier, grandpa kind of homey person to make the rhetoric sound palpable. And this was not the country club party, even though Reagan loved horses and he loved cars and he lived very well. But he thought like his roots. He thought like he was still in Tampico, Illinois, working with a father who couldn't stay sober very long, and respected him, but had to change schools every year because the old man was always losing a job and they kept losing their apartments and bouncing around. That's what Ronald Reagan thought he was, even though he was loved nice things, he particularly loved horses and ranches. But the old Ronald Reagan never went away. He always knew where he came from.
Uh-huh.
And that's what he thought we needed to do to change the country. And he did a magnificent job.
I'm trying to remember the George Will construction. No William Buckley, no Barry Goldwater, no Barry Goldwater, no Ronald Reagan, no Ronald Reagan, no empty iron curtain from Stettin to Trieste, something like that.
That's right.
Something close to that. The most special thing in the whole thing, I got to tell you, Al, it just moved me, and I had known stories of it, and I'd never fully assimilated or appreciated it,
was the story Milton Friedman told when he asked all his friends what his greatest attribute was. His speech, Buckley's greatest attribute was his speech giving, debating, you name it. He said his greatest skill was friendship. I thought that was beautiful. Yes. That was beautiful.
No, he made that into an art.
Yeah.
And he gave lots of his time to his friends and to their children, particularly people who were sick, people who were needy. He would just turn up and provide old-fashioned charity. Sometimes people didn't even know that it was coming from him. And he had a big heart, and he had time for everyone. And he had two secretaries making sure that he kept his two-minute appointment in 2 minutes, because he had 50 of them to go, you know. They all wanted their time with him.
Yeah.
He also had great wit. I mean, he showed that at the opening moment when he was on Laugh-In, and they asked why he always sat down on his program.
Yeah.
And he just thinks of these things, or thought of these things, quite effectively. He never sat still. He crammed a lot of years into 81 years, and a lot of careers into it. He was always on the go.
And he made a lot of careers. Harry Jaffa said he wouldn't have had his career without William Buckley.
Well, a lot of people say that.
Yeah. Yeah,
many people I could think about.
Yeah.
Many writers, even writers on the other side.
Yeah, yeah.
John Lennon was the great music critic. Joan Didion was discovered by William Buckley.
That's
then
right.
She became a great liberal. You know,
that's right. Jeff Greenfield, maybe.
Jeff Greenfield. I think they overdo the friendship with Norman Mailer, and I think.
Yeah, I don't remember that being that big of a deal, frankly. Either.
It was big with Galbraith.
And yeah, John Kenneth Galbraith, to be sure. Yeah, they were best buds, but I don't remember him being that close to Mailer. They weren't much alike. What was his best book to you? If you were to tell someone to read a Buckley book, which book would it be, other than yours?
The Unmaking of a Mayor.
That's what I think. I think it is the best book.
Absolutely.
I do, too.
I would ask everyone to get it. I'm surprised it never became a movie. It deals with an amateur politician, but by no means an ignoramus about politics, but an amateur about politics and spin and all of that. And he announces the mayor and how people twist his words and how they demagogue everything they do. And some rather mature gentlemen engaged in this gutter kind of politics. Mm-hmm. And he just kept his cool, mm-hmm. kept his own,
mm-hmm.
and he kept moving along.
Yeah.
And also, he had the ability to be candid because he didn't want the job to begin with.
Right.
So they asked him a question, he'd answer it, and Lindsay would be thinking of Tomorrow's Pulse.
Yeah,
Bean would be thinking how the municipal workers would respond to it.
Yeah,
and he just said what was in his mind.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was very refreshing to have that.
Yeah, liberating.
A lot of people thought he would do it again, but he decided, you know, you can't. Second acts are not very easy in this game.
Yeah.
And he said he already proved that conservatism had an audience.
Yep.
And passed the baton. And, of course, his brother became a very effective senator from New York.
That's right.
And he just died at the age of 100, James Buckley.
That's right.
I want to give you this one. He probably did more in 4 years than many people do in many terms.
I imagine.
He passed the Protection of Student Records Act, where parents or students, if the students were of age, fine, but if they weren't, parents have a right to know what information about their students are being sent to third parties, like universities and military recruiters and job employers and all of that. He filed has his name on a Supreme Court opinion, the Buckley-Vallejo Act, which said you could give an unlimited amount to your own campaign. And so could PACs, but you can't get a limit to other people's campaign, but it's your money and it's a form of speech.
He did that. Yeah.
American kid out of Turkey.
In
Midnight Express.
Yep.
Because he called his college classmate, John Chafee, who was Secretary of the Navy, and he said, get him out.
Yeah.
And a very effective senator.
You're a very effective teacher and friend, Al. Thank you for doing this hour with us.
Well, lots of luck to you.
Thank you, brother. I was trying to think what friendship story about Bill Buckley I wanted to tell, the Milton Friedman line, and I think it might be this one. I have many. But he was scheduled, Buckley, to give a speech. I think it was UC Irvine. in Irvine, California, Southern California. And he had made an appointment to have dinner with Harry Jaffa, who was in Claremont, I don't know, an hour away, something like that, hour and a half by car maybe. And Harry kind of got it a little bit confused in that Harry, who drove what he described as a jalopy, and it kind of was, Harry drove his. Harry thought he was supposed to pick Bill Buckley up at the college at Irvine and then drive them back to Claremont for dinner. Buckley had scheduled his limousine to drive him from Irvine to Claremont to meet Harry for dinner. And Jaffa pulls up right when Buckley's limo pulls up, and Buckley, immediately realizing the mistake that took place here, got in Harry's car and had his limo follow them all the way back to Claremont, but driving with Harry. And, you know, just small little graces like that. I remember when Harry didn't have, these are stories Harry would tell, Harry didn't have enough money to go see his son graduate from Yale. And Buckley said no fathers should miss their son's graduation. He sent Harry the money to do all that. Just a great human being in so many respects. But yeah, the way I'll put it is right. He changed the world. He changed the world because he changed the conservative movement. And, you know, like anything, I guess the plea I would have is, what are we doing with that inheritance? I think that's a question that's worth asking from time to time. How are we doing with that inheritance? Are we tending more towards what Buckley stood for and taught, or more away from it? Some days the answers vary. But if you wanted a North Star that gave us every victory we still say we appreciate, that's the North Star. And it's probably worth going back to those classics, those oak trees, from time to time, just as he encouraged us to go back to a book he wrote with Charles Kessler called Keeping the Tablets, which was about, you know, the tablets of America, the tablets of Western political philosophy that became the etched words of conservatism. All right, that's all I got on that. That's all I have to say about that, to quote Forrest Gump. Brandon Weigert coming right up. We'll be right back.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.